All right, here, this is tape yeah. three. So, I'm sorry, go ahead
yeah,
and finish
well,
your...
finally, this idea did come to fruition, and we spent 3 summers ourselves in New York. The first summer, when he was making arrangements for 20 students to come there from Wisconsin and spend 8 weeks working as they would have here in Madison, and they would get the same credit as they would have here in Madison. And they were students from all over the state, from not only UW-Madison, but the other university institutions mm-hmm. in the state. And then the following summer, the arrangements had all been made, and it was set up, and we were there again, and he conducted it himself with an administrative assistant. And since then, it's been run by, it's continued, and it's been abbreviated because of funds, mainly, and is run out of Milwaukee, University of Milwaukee. Mm. But it's still being done, and students that have participated in it have all been very, well, thoughtful about telling him later how much they'd appreciate it and how much they'd got out of it. The idea was not to have it be a specialty for students that were going to go into international law or international relations, but to have students from all kinds of disciplines from the various institutions in the state mm-hmm. participate, so that you would spread the idea of international relations around. It was not to be a professional thing for the student. It was to be an educational thing to widen their horizons, yeah. I'd say.
Did you go to New York, too?
Oh, yeah.
Did you like that?
Loved it. Sure. It was great.
You had an apartment? And
yes. This was always one of the first things to do, to find ourselves an apartment and find housing for the students. And we had marvelous luck that way. First year, I had a flat that was belonged to a retired ballet dancer and his French wife. There were wonderful pictures around.
Yeah.
They had a summer place out on Long Island, a tiny little cottage, and we were out there, visited them out there. And that was on Fifth Avenue and 11th Street, so it was right in the heart of things. Mm. The other two apartments were, too. The third one was a tiny thing right near the UN that belonged to a French woman who was a reporter on the staff of the UN. She was back in France that summer. So, and the students would come over, and it was just a great experience. And always there would be some crisis or other going on at the UN that would be much more fun close by than just reading about it in the paper from out here.
Did you ever go on trips on your own?
You mean what kind of trip?
Well, off for a vacation by yourself.
You mean me?
Yes.
Myself?
Yes.
Well, let me think. Oh, when I went off to political conventions or visited my relatives in Milwaukee or something like that. Never really, like what?
Just that. You did do
that. Probably couldn't
that.
Afford it.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't have occurred to me, I don't think. When would there have been time?
Probably not. maybe after the children had left home. And
I don't know. Never thought of it that way.
I'd like to ask you whether, when you think back over your life and compare it to your husband's, have you ever regretted the fact that he has devoted his life to a single activity in which he's developed expertise and has made a contribution, and that you have been much more dispersed? Is that something that you've ever thought about in what you've done?
Well, I'm sure I've thought about it from time to time, but never with regret, because I suppose what I would have regretted was if I'd started out on a real career venture and had to give it up some way or other. The time to have thought about that was in 1932, when I married that summer, I think.
Well, one does think back and say, now that I see what people are doing, I wish that I had done this or that. Or, but not,
well, and
you may
I
feel that
have
way.
To
I'm
say that
curious.
I thought about it at that time because that definitely made a difference, you see, whether I stayed in Minneapolis and went to school there or came on here and started a married life, which was combined with going to school then, but certainly not in the same way that going to school would have been just as straight. Business aimed at a career, which I never did do then, you see. And I got interested in many things, and I suppose was leading what people used to call the full life.
And you felt it was?
I've never felt, I have to say, I've never been bored. In any way.
Well, that's another way of looking at the question. When you compare your life to your husband's, do you feel that, in fact, you've had more chances of doing more things and had, in a way, more variety and more chance to grow than he has? Is that something that's occurred
to
you?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, how do you grow? I mean, he's had other interests. He's always been interested in music, and he was a member of the Philharmonic Chorus for a long time. There hasn't been any hindrance, really, to doing things that we wanted to do if we wanted to do something separately. No, I don't think, certainly couldn't see that, say that there were regrets. I don't know about him. Can't speak for him.
Well, the point of my question, I think, is that when we people, those of us who haven't pursued a single career, look at other women who are doing so,
mm-hmm.
we may either say, I wish that I had done that, I wish that I had put all of my energy mm-hmm. into one thing, or mm-hmm. we might say, I haven't done that, but I've done so many different things that I feel I've mm-hmm. I mean, you've learned things about Indonesia in one job and about the third mm-hmm. world in the land tenure job, so that you get a variety of experiences of the world that mm-hmm. you might not have had in career. That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Has
uh-huh.
has it occurred to you either way that either you regret not focusing or you're glad you didn't or you've just not thought of it?
I don't know. I guess I just have a different philosophy that doesn't include those concepts at all.
What is it?
Well, you just have one life to live, and you make choices all the way along.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain things that you just have to do if you've made a choice. And
then
they
take
time. What
would you characterize as those things that you have to do?
Well, if you've decided to go to school, you have to get in the studying and do the coursework and that sort of thing. And meanwhile, if you're keeping house, you have to see that things are done and particularly the meals are there. And then with children, you and your husband both have to take some time to, and you usually want to, seems to me, at least I did, to read to them and talk with them and be friends with them, as well as, we didn't do very much about PTA meetings. I must say our life wasn't absorbed by them, but as far as the children were concerned. But you do take a great deal of time just within that groove that you've really set for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever said I had to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There it was. So I do think that women now have been conditioned to think of things differently for the most part. I think my mother's regret was that she hadn't gone to school farther. She grew up in Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and married my father and went out to this little town, South Dakota, and people would ask her what university she was from, and she'd be so amused by that because I think she went through eighth grade. And she had a marvelous life there for a while during the boom years. And then she just had one rugged life of trying to make ends meet. So that was one kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am. No, or give her a substitute time.
Mm-hmm. What motivated you to go into to run for the assembly?
Oh, well, I got interested in politics way back in 1951. Before that, in the 40s, in the Roosevelt days.
That was when you thought you could save the world. Is that right? You said something in the last time.
Did that remark get on the tape?
Yes, it did.
Well, that's looking back. I'm sure I didn't go at it with that motivation, but I think I felt more strongly then that whatever you did would have more effect than I do now. Just partly part of the aging process, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would plunge into things in those days. And it was a marvelously creative time, I think, because of the building of the Democratic Party here in the county and in the state, and with the national ties, with the creative New Deal days, which, of course, Llewellyn was part of when he was in the Department of Agriculture and we went to Washington.
Yeah.
And so part of that may have spilled over.
Mm-hmm.
We got to know just a whole raft of very creative and very bright people in Washington during that period, and that just led me into the groove of working in politics here. And
I suppose it was actually that you ran for county board first.
Yeah.
Was this on your own initiative, or did somebody suggest that you do it?
Both. Both. And it was, well, Mr. Onstad had been in the county board for some time and was quite entrenched, and so in a way it was more of an exercise than anything else, but it was not done as an exercise. It was done with the thought that just possibly you might win, which I was hoping to do and didn't.
Did you work hard at it? Did you
go
door to door?
Sure, but had just no organization, and it was really a very... well, it was a lonely thing to do, and it much much more so than it would be now, I think,
yes,
because I didn't have a large group of people. There wasn't a party group then for support. I know it's a nonpartisan office, but all the same, nonpartisan people depend on party people for support in both parties. And there wasn't that kind of thing, and I didn't have any personal organization that was large. But I did feel when I started doing it that probably my work in the League of Women Voters and having lived here for a while at that time would give me enough of a group. And there were a great many people around the ward that were supportive. It wasn't quite as bleak as I sounded at first, but not enough to win. So.
And you didn't try again?
Not for county board, no.
The assembly was much more ambitious to run for assembly.
Yeah, that's true.
With what spirit did you do that?
That was, then you see you had party support, and had a great many people working for me and with me, and we just felt that it was a time when possibly could make a breakthrough in the Democratic Party in this area. But of course it was a Republican area, and Mr. Yielding had been in for some time, and I think that was a kind of transition period when women were still looked at as peculiar if they were being in active politics.
There would have been very few, because even now it's talked about.
Although Ruth Doyle had made the breakthrough before, but she did it at a time when Madison was one assembly district. And so after she was out of the assembly. It was, it became three districts
mm-hmm.
through redistricting.
And you got a Republican district.
And this was the Republican district. Mm-hmm. So that, but it was a good effort and was lots of fun to do.
Was he helpful?
He was supportive. He would never be a doorbell ringer or a telephoner, mm-hmm. anything like that. He was always very supportive.
Was he interested in it? I mean, did he ask you about how things were going?
Some. Not. He wasn't, really interested in the details very much.
Well, you must have been terribly, that's a very engrossing thing to do, to run for office.
Yeah.
Even if it's not for a terribly long
work.
Period.
It's yeah. work. That's true. There's nothing that's more fun if you enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, but you did enjoy it.
Oh, yes, very much. I think I'm practically certain that if I'd been 10 or 20 years younger, see, I was 52 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'd done a great deal of work in politics of all kinds, I'd never been a candidate myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an education, because it's quite a different thing to be a candidate than it is to work for a candidate.
It just for anybody, or particularly because you were a woman, or?
Oh, I think it would be for anyone. Thinking back, because for one thing, I should have had a campaign manager, which I never did really have. Thought I could do without it, and this is something everyone must have. And I found as I was running for office, working, that many of the things I was doing, I had been doing for other people, but never thought about in that way. And so here I was being the worker as well as the candidate. And this is what I mean when I say it's quite a different thing.
Yeah.
While many of the candidates in the early days, like Gaylord Nelson and Hoss Wilkie and people back there, had just assumed that the organization would work for them, and they worked hard. But doing the things they should be doing, like being out making the speeches and so on.
So that was just a
matter of experience.
Well, I was
doing many of the details that I shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah, that's the
simply
sort of
because I hadn't organized it well enough myself, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It was probably my own fault. But I did have a lot of help. And actually it was something like our recent mayoral race, because got more votes in the primary than Mr. Ewling did, which made many people too optimistic. Well, you see, there wasn't really a... Neither one of us had opposition in our primary, but there was a primary election,
mm-hmm.
and so our names were on the ballot, and more people apparently had voted in the Democratic primary than in the Republican, and so this gave entirely erroneous view to people about what the election was going to be like. So I lost by a very small margin. That's, I think, about 48 to over... Round 48 to 52.
Why
does that add up to 100?
Yes.
Okay.
Why didn't you try again?
Well, I think mainly because I just didn't feel that that was a time of life when I wanted to really go at it again.
I see. Mm-hmm.
It may be a watershed. I didn't really think about it a great deal, but I know. The next person that ran, I can't even remember his name, was a young man, and then another young man ran the next time, and then the third time after my candidacy was the one that Midge Miller came. And by this time, you see, she had a very strong issue, the war issue.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was running, there weren't any overriding issues either. This was another key factor.
I see that,
really.
Yeah.
And so... She's been in ever since. So she overcame the woman thing in this district. And many other women have now, of course. I never really looked at it as a woman thing, but I think I mentioned earlier that somebody said to me, well, it's wonderful that your husband will let you do this. I certainly hadn't thought about it in that way, and I think he would have been amused by that too.
You seem to have been remarkably free of any of the, I don't know, the resentments that many women have felt from being women and being sort of left mm-hmm. in second place. Is that right?
Yeah, I can't think that I've thought about it very much. Really.
Hmm.
It's partly the time, you know, times, the era. And you simply can't be two people. You make choices as you go along. And
well, when the women's movement did come along, what did you think about it? I mean, as you became aware of it.
Looking back, actually, I had been active in the League of Women Voters ever since Mrs. Ogg enrolled me without even asking me, and of course had become aware of special roles for women, I suppose, through that, because that was a very active and very, in an organization of very able women, very intelligent women. And I'd been, Ruth Warrington and I got the first discussion groups going when the League reorganized itself in that format here in town.
When was that?
And we had a lot of fun setting those up. Must have been the 40s. I suppose I didn't regard women as being downtrodden or not having any opportunity to express themselves. I mean, I can't remember feeling that they were frustrated people.
You did quote,
really.
You remember last time you quoted the sentence that you read in about women in academic life that
yeah,
you read for your paper.
Back there.
Did that linger in your mind? Did you
I don't
think
suppose
about
it
that?
Lingered because I had, you know, I'd written that thing in Milwaukee in 1929 or 30,
mm-hmm.
and it certainly didn't linger.
Yeah.
But I have thought about it periodically over the years.
And what have you...
I think that the women's movement on the whole has given a tremendous lift to that aspect of women's role, because I think that's the most important of all. That was when the teacher in college teaching had felt frustrated because women weren't being paid
on the
same basis as men,
mm-hmm.
which to me is a legitimate gripe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably one of the most important gripes of all that the women have. So I think on the whole it's been a healthy thing. I think that it's going to be a disappointment for many women, just as it does for many people in the minorities, because while you can create an uplift for the group as a whole and legislate so that a person with a complaint has a place to go to voice that complaint that can be effective, still there will always be people that... If put in competition, really can't compete with other individuals as individuals. And I think if women go into it thinking that because women now have more of a place in society, more equality, that they themselves then can ride along on that. Some people mm. will be doing this.
That's a good point, yes.
And this is where it gets very tough, not only for them, but for people dealing with the problem outside of them, themselves. So, but that's an aspect of it that just comes along with the whole movement, whether it's of minorities or of women. Women aren't really a minority, they're a majority.
Mm.
And I suppose the fact that they are numerically a majority doesn't always help them, because then they get people like Phyllis Schlafly, who's also part of that majority, and she's on what I consider the wrong side.
Mm.
So I think the women's movement as a whole is a healthy thing. I haven't felt that I needed to participate in it because I didn't have time to participate in it as such. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if I had had three times as much time as I did through life, I would have done three or four more things.
Well, actually,
really,
and
more
it doesn't
professionally
seem to
than I ever did.
Caused you to reassess your life.
My own life, no, because it came along too far along for mm-hmm. that, I think.
Did Llewellyn, do you talk about it with him? Does he ever express opinions on it?
I don't know. Huh. Gee, that's too bad. You back?
Yes.
I can't say that we've ever talked about it, you know, as a lengthy topic of discussion.
That's extraordinary.
It is?
Yeah.
Well, Llewellyn's always been very much in favor of women. When Kay Frederick came along, you know, she was in the department. He's out, and Carol Edler Bauman, who's now in New York and was with, or in Milwaukee, she was in New York, and she's made a real career and went into her marriage with the idea that she would have a career and has had and has a very cooperative husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he thinks he's had a cooperative wife. At any rate, Llewellyn's always been, I don't know how I can say, supportive of women that have come along in the discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we've ever had any differences there.
And but insofar as things having to do with the house, you haven't. It's not something that you discuss.
You mean who's going to do this and who's going to do that?
Well, just what should be the roles of people, and should they be different from what they used to be?
No, we don't talk about that. I mean, not because we don't want to. It just isn't one of the things that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's more fun to talk about other things like Ronald Reagan or
yeah
or what's going on in the family or the current local election or something like that.
You know, as you
or music or plays.
Yes, actually, I was thinking of it as a topic of a theory rather than. I meant discussing it as one of the developments in the modern world, but evidently you haven't.
No, we don't do that much, I guess. I mean,
yes, that's interesting. Most people that I'm aware of, it has become something that husbands and wives are thinking about it, uh-huh. talking about it, and trying to make adjustments in. And,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. as you've answered the phone a couple of times, I've been sitting here looking at your house and realized that I look at men's offices. I'm more, you know, it's interesting to see how they surround themselves. Mm-hmm. But a house is a very important part of a woman's life. I think that's fair to say, even the most modern career woman, maybe of men too. But you have a very relaxed, mm-hmm. easygoing house. Is this something that is this your own creation, or is it Llewellyn's also, or how does it come about?
Well, it's certainly both. I must say that the decor of the house hasn't been uppermost in either of our minds over the years. At one time it was a matter of trying to get enough money together to buy another chair.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think the economics of our lives have been important because we've never had too much money.
You've mentioned it several times.
Then we both had families, and we've each of us is an only child, let me say that. So that when parents have died and the houses had to be broken up, there was just one person to go do it. And so then some of the furniture would come here, and so this is why you could call it what Professor Kiekhofer used to say, the campus was an eclectic campus architecturally, mm. Well, this is an eclectic house.
Yeah.
As far as the furnishings go. And been a few things that, now, that Navajo rug you're sitting on is my pride and joy, and we've had that since we were in New York 1 year. Years, 20, 25 years, I guess. And but aside from one or two things like that, and then old grandpa, his portrait came all the way from Germany years ago.
Yeah.
Is painted on a board by my artist cousin over there who was killed in the war when he was very, very young, and it's kind of an heirloom. And people don't know if it's Karl Marx or Johannes Brahms, but actually it's Grandpa Kohler. So, anyway, I enjoy your comment. That's the kind of house it is. And right now, it's getting very shabby, and I need to get cleaning done. And at this stage of life, you know, like the walls washed, you don't feel you want to get into lots of expense, because you keep thinking, well, if the house is sold, whoever bought it would want to choose their own colors and things anyway. She'd been doing the same thing. Then, of course, she had a terrible robbery. Is this on?
Yes. Oh, I mean, she's one of the people. She has been interviewed by for one of these interviews. I didn't do it, but
Well, let me think now. One of the things I was going to tell you about when we first came here, of course, it was a great new world to me and to Llewellyn too, because his only job after he'd received his doctorate at Harvard was teaching at Duke University for a year, and that was a temporary job when he took it on. He knew it was when he took it on. And so this was the first job that would be considered a real career job to him. And then, as it's turned out, aside from some periods away, he's been here ever since. But that about 3 months after we'd come here in January, I think it was, end of January, Llewellyn came home and said that somebody at the office had told him that Fulala Follett was home on the farm and was looking for somebody to do some stenographic work for her. And so I thought that'd be a wonderful opportunity. And so I got in the car, our little Model A, which I was just learning to drive, and got myself out there after calling her. And did about three sessions with her, three different days. And she had been ill at Christmas time and had a whole vast bunch of correspondence that she hadn't been able to get to. And she was actually answering all of her Christmas mail, every letter and card, and explaining that she hadn't been able to do it before that. And she was just a marvelous person. I was amazed at how tiny she was, because she was an actress, you know, and I always think it takes a rather tall person to make a presence on the stage. But she was very tiny and the most marvelous person, a very pleasant person. Then she was also working on her mother's biography of her father at that point, and asked me to check some things over in the historical library, which I did for her. And her husband, George Middleton, the playwright, was there. I suppose they'd been there over the Christmas period, too. And at lunchtime, we sat
her
down.
Her husband?
Fola the Follett's husband. See, Fola was old Bob's daughter. And George Middleton was her husband.
And what relation was she to Bob the Follett?
You mean the junior senator?
The governor during the 30s.
Phil La Follett. She was his sister.
Oh, I see. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
She would have been an aunt of Bronson La Follett's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, anyway, that brief session was a very interesting thing to do. And then we sat down at the table, and they had a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Quant, who took care of the farm, and the farm... The house, which is still there, of course, and has been remodeled, but is a historic house. Have you been in it? Ever been in it out there? The farm at that time had much more land around it, because the property hadn't been sold off to Maple Bluff Houses at that point. And so drove the car into the yard, and in order to get back, I had to back the car up, and I couldn't figure out how to turn it around, so Mr. Quant had to come out and get me headed back home. And at lunchtime, Mrs. Quant had made the, all these years, I remember this detail, most gorgeous filet that I'd had and I think ever have had. And so we all sat down and had a very pleasant lunch before Full and I went back to work. And this house was quite a revelation to me, and she was very fond of it, obviously, just loved the old house, and pointed out that there weren't any closets in the bedrooms, and she said she really liked wardrobes much better than closets. All the bedrooms had big wardrobes in them. So that was one experience that I hadn't talked about earlier. And never would have had it if I hadn't been here close to the campus, because that's where somebody over there in political science had got the word that she needed somebody. Yeah. And then just being close to the campus and being able to go to school without very much effort.
Yeah, that's a luxury.
Walk up the hill.
You know, you must have been certainly very, felt very strongly during the McCarthy era and what preceded it.
Well, yeah.
I'd be interested in what your perceptions were of how the whole thing was handled on the campus. Everybody says that the campus wasn't affected by it and that McCarthy didn't, which is true, that he didn't attack the university, but there were things going on.
That it wasn't affected by him?
That he didn't attack the University of Wisconsin the way he did other universities.
Oh. But,
well, go ahead.
Well, maybe not as a university, but his attack was on intellectuals everywhere. I mean, his attack was very general. Well, that's true. It probably wasn't specific. Well, it was during that period, of course, that Llewellyn was chairman of the department when the Howard McMurray episode came up. And Howard Didbrand was in Congress for a while, and I understand used his experience in Congress to enrich his teaching. Students that had had him said he did, and that he was not partisan in his teaching. But, of course, the issue then became whether he would be given tenure in the university and still be allowed to be political. Well, I'm simplifying the issue. And I myself wasn't involved directly in it, but it was a very hot issue on the campus. And I have to say this spilled over, because by this time I was actively involved in Democratic politics and knew Howard McMurray and supported him as a candidate for office when he became a candidate what was it, U.S. Senate.
Max Otto expressed the, I think in a letter or else it was, he was quoted as feeling that this was the end of academic freedom at the university. He felt very strongly about it, about how McMurray's not being kept on.
I think it was a shameful thing myself, and I'm speaking for myself, because one thing, I never attempted to speak for Llewellyn, because I felt he was professional and I had no business speaking for him. This is one thing that I think some people over the campus, I can't think of a specific instance, but I do feel some wives became so immersed in their husband's profession and that they were almost an alter ego.
Yes.
Now, I have this feeling very strongly, but I can't think of one single example that I could give you, but probably wouldn't if I could think of it, but I really can't think of it. But I did feel this very strongly, and that I never felt that I never wanted to be that way, and I couldn't have been that way, and so...
So you wouldn't express your opinions about departmental affairs and what you thought ought to be done? Or?
No, not for that, but I do know that Llewellyn did work very hard to support the principle of academic freedom, and did feel that McMurray should have been given tenure. And then, of course, when he ran for office, this was very important to me, because later, you know, he ran as a Democrat, and this was the real rift in the progressive Democratic Party relationship that many people felt that by LaFollette should have been supported by the Democrats, and Ed Hard McMurray was running, and he was the Democratic candidate and was performing a very needed role in the party as a supporter of Roosevelt and as building up the Democratic Party. Can't have a party without candidates.
Hmm.
So at that time, let's see, I guess Heidi must have been still about 2 years old. I remember Jane Wood called me up. She's not a faculty person, but she was active in the League of Women Voters. And I was a member but hadn't been active for a while. And Jane said, it's time you got back into things. And we need to do a presentation on WHA on the Senate race. And this had to be a nonpartisan thing. And so I demurred. But we did do the piece strictly from the point of view of the candidate's stance on issues.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after the primary, I think, and it was at that point simply on Wiley and McMurray. But this is one of the things I did do along the way there that kind of got me back active when
I've
been a house sprawl for a while.
Do you remember any of the there were various excitements of the regents like Campbell were attacking people in the university.
Mm-hmm.
People in the university were signing. For instance, there was a statement about the trial of 12 people who were accused of being communists.
Mm-hmm.
And Harrington and Agar and various other people signed a mm-hmm. protest about the trial.
Uh-huh.
Do you
I don't know if
Llewellyn
signed that or not. I really don't know.
No, I don't think he did. Well, it wasn't, you know, there were only, I suppose, about 15 signatures on it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, Campbell had wondered about Harrington's doing that. Harrington was already rather prominent.
Oh.
So I just wonder if you, or then later uh-huh. there were the Joe Must Go campaign.
Yes, uh-huh. Well, of course, I was actively involved in that. I remember when Dr. Robert Becker here in town became chairman of the Dane County Joe Must Go movement. And, well, that was a period of real turmoil. And what I, well, in recollection, it seems to me that it took just an enormous amount of energy and effort and courage to buck what should have been a very small, insignificant thing, really. And how this could balloon into something as big and evil as it was, it was really a phenomenon.
Mm.
And it must have been similar to the Hitler phenomenon in Germany, actually. It was a very serious thing.
Yes.
And it shouldn't have required that much courage, but it did take, I mean, it shouldn't have had to be a courageous thing to do to sign a petition like that. People,
well,
particularly
that
academic
was, yeah.
people, ought to be free to express themselves on important issues.
Do you remember, did you know E.B. Fred at all? Did you?
Oh, yes.
Did
and Mrs. Fred, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you have a, what was your sense of how things were on the campus? I mean, there were conservatives on campus, and did you feel that people were adequately protected on campus in their rights to sign petitions?
I don't know, because I wasn't part of the faculty.
Oh,
I really don't know.
I see.
And being an odd student, I never was part of campus politics either, because, I was an older student. In my youth, I was the youngest person around, usually, and then as time went along, I'd be the oldest person in class.
So
that's the way it went.
Yeah, the Joe Must Go movement, you thought of it, it was a county and city.
And
but
state.
There were faculty, but I mean...
Oh, faculty people were involved, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I remember,
Who they were?
A huge ad, one or two pages of people from all... No, I can't remember.
Huh, I ought to look for that.
I can't remember names at all. I think I have a copy if I ever get it.
Hmm. If you ever do find it, I'd like to see it. Because I don't know that
Oh, there were always a great many faculty people involved in mm-hmm. these things. And as well as many townspeople. And, of course, through the activity in politics, I got acquainted with many townspeople, labor people, others that I probably wouldn't have got acquainted with if I hadn't been active in politics.
Did you know Carl Paul Link?
Yes, and Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. You did. Mm-hmm. What was your opinion of him?
Oh, I thought he was a wonderfully brilliant, great individual. And apparently, he was very successful professionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very outspoken. He was unique.
The Regents wanted him to resign. I mean, they resented very much his. Mm-hmm. Was the advisor to a couple of left wing groups on campus on principle. He just they had a right to have a faculty advisor, and he got severely criticized for this.
I don't know the complete makeup of the Regents in those days, but I think it was completely a Republican board of Regents.
It was quite a conservative board.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think not only conservative, but I think that I think the appointments had all been made by Republicans. So that would have something to do with it, you see, because Joe McCarthy was a Republican, and even though ostensibly they were not partisan as regents, still it just does carry over.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be supporting their own.
Campbell and Sensenbrenner are the ones one hears about as being the most most conservative.
Yeah,
that
I remember. But I don't remember the composition of the board otherwise. Yeah. And I was active in University League in those days, but of course that was a completely non-political group, so that at board meetings, politics never came up.
Mm.
And that's an organization that I am amazed has thrived over the years, because many women's organizations have dwindled, so particularly church women's groups, I think, have become very small. And
Why were you active in the league?
Well, when we first came here, Setsy Pooley particularly was, we knew the Pooleys, English department, and she was a member of the board of the junior division of the league. It was junior division in those days, not newcomers. And just felt that I ought to get to know people and come over and be active, and so I got active in it. Was on the junior division board for a while, and it was fun. They were doing lots of social things.
Mm-hmm.
Dances and things to go to that were fun, good social life. So,
did you go on being active in the league?
Not during the years that I was working. I didn't. But I'm a member of a league book group now. That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
I've kept up my membership. So, but I think that the league probably was a reflection of the enormous talents and creativeness of a lot of faculty wives all across the years from that time up to the present. Mm-hmm. They just do marvelous things. Mm. Great bunch of girls. That's not a women's lib expression, is it?
No, it certainly isn't.
I still like it. Sorry, but I do. Yeah. So, well, that got away from the political thing. League of Women Voters, I was very active in for quite a while, and there again, of course, they could not be political in a partisan sense. And this gets very difficult, because when it comes to a person like Joe McCarthy, you can only attack what he's doing on the issues. This becomes very difficult. So, well, that whole period has been documented and redocumented. But it was different, I think, to be close to it and part of it than to just read about it.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be. Because I did know a lot of people that were going around with the Joe Must Go Operation Truth. Jim Doyle and Tom Fairchild and some of the other people had a little project going around the state following Joe's appearances with their Operation Truth.
Gee.
I never went out on one of those. I wish I had. Just heard about them and knew about them, knew they were going on. Well, there were just many valiant efforts being made to combat this very ignoramus kind of operation that Joe was conducting. Sometimes I'm not sure that he really knew what he was doing, and this would be a shocking statement to many people, because in one way he knew very well what he was doing, but he was such a flamboyant politician that probably the more attention he got, the more he thrived on it, and the tougher he would get. He certainly had no scruples about what harm he was doing to other people's characters and personalities and careers. So that whole period and the economic scene and the New Deal period and all of that probably had more to do with what I did with my life than anything else that could have gone on at that time. Because in a way, I was probably a character that should have gone up into an ivory tower and become a scholar. I did make Phi Beta Kappa, you know, in college.
Did you?
Didn't know it until I'd taken an exam and I wasn't even out of bed, and the telephone rang, and Mrs. Whitty was on the phone all excited. She was the sweetest little person. Did you ever know her, Mrs.
No.
Ed Whitty? She was the person that was a homebody, I think. I don't think she ever tried to work outside the house and took care of Ed and family and her house, but had very pronounced views on things. She was no wallflower at all. She was very active and very vocal about things, but she said, "Congratulations." And she'd just been reading the State Journal that morning and seen my name in the list of Phi Betas. And I wasn't even aware, you know. What are you saying? It was very funny. I think I got more of a thrill out of that than the honor, if that's possible.
You mean from her phone call?
Yeah. Hmm. The fact that she cared so much and thought it was so wonderful. Yeah.
Do you still go to the dinners?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, because Llewellyn was a Phi Beta from Minnesota, and it's always been kind of a fun thing for us both to.
That's one our thing. Two children have made it, one so
little,
we get to go to the
one little tradition that we have, that we do go when we can.
Yeah. Yeah. I will be going in May to the dinner.
Oh, you have a graduate?
Yes, our son is just actually second son. The first one got it 2 years ago, and now the second one. It was very nice.
So, and I suppose of all the things that I've done, I've got as much kick out of the classes that I took on campus, and I was particularly taken with the 17 courses in science. Whether they're still doing that or not, I don't know. And the Llewellyn, of course, has always been interested in ILS and the contemporary trends courses too, as things that were give special lift to areas of the university.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the 17 courses were science courses for people that weren't going to specialize in science.
Uh-huh.
And they were all given by top-notch people. And I took the astronomy one and the physical geography, physiology, with Dr. Meek.
Really?
Who was just a marvelous lecturer.
I didn't know about these.
Marvelous person. They were one-semester courses. Very concentrated. You squeezed a lot in. And for the physiology course, the nurses taking it had to do extra work or an extra semester. But otherwise, we were getting the very same course that you'd be taking if you were majoring in it, but with a shortened space of time to do it in. So Dr. Meek was just, you'd have to be there listening to his lectures to appreciate it, I think. And then I had Professor Huffer in astronomy. And it was just a real privilege, really, to
part of your undergraduate,
be here and be able to. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Coursework.
And then I never did graduate work, because once my undergraduate work is finished, actually, when I was supposed to graduate, I was lacking 2 credits. And these hung over me till the summer of 1945. And Llewellyn was in San Francisco. I thought, this marvelous chance to go back, finish up, and get my. So then I took the 3 credit, which was a graduate course.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I majored in German, this was the only course I had where the lectures were all in German, and where I really felt I was getting graduate look at things.
Helmut
Rader, who was Julius Rader, you probably don't know him. He lived here for a long time.
Name,
he was a German expatriate from Hitler. And Helmut Rader was his son, who was here in the German department for quite some time. And just a marvelously learned German literature person.
But you were saying why you didn't go into graduate work.
Well,
did you think of it?
I did think about it for a while. But it would have meant cutting off everything else that I was doing, you see. You'd have to.
You mean the political things?
And I wasn't sure there was any, yes, and that, and just generally life had just taken other courses of action. And it would have been a something that I would have had to decide, a field that I really cared about enough to go into and go on, not only, of course, for an MA, but a PhD. It wouldn't have been any point in doing it.
Have you kept
up? And there wasn't anything that really appealed to me that much.
Have you kept up at all in your reading in German literature? Or?
Not a lot. I do appreciate being able to read it. It's good. And then when we visited my relatives in Germany, of course, it was a great opportunity to try it out some. Although they thought my German was terrible, and I thought their English was terrible. So we got along fine. Because my German was school German, and they had a dialect.
But that's interesting that you say that you would have probably been a scholar, that probably was your...
Well, everything
forte.
Led that way in my early life, you know.
Yeah.
But then economics pretty much determined it. I say that it has as much to do with things as anything. The economic situation. So...
Well, I think we're just about at the end of the tape, and I imagine we've covered most things.
By the time I knew her voice was gone, she knew it, had the sense to know it. But she said one time, "Oh, every woman should have something outside the home."
Mm-hmm.
And so the League of Women Voters became her big thing outside the home. And then I remember when we went to call on the Rices, Rosamond Rice said, this was right after we'd come here, asked me what my interest was. And I was a little taken aback because at that point I didn't have any special interest. And I just got married, and everything was just new and wide open. And I really didn't know what my interest was. Except music, maybe that's what I said, I can't remember. Can't remember what I said to her, which is very funny. Because, of course, she'd been interested in the League, and...
It's interesting that they would have thought of asking. I don't think that if you came here now as a new member of the faculty wife, that anybody would ask you that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a way, it's a good question to ask people because it's a way of looking at things.
And establishing some kind of conversation.
Yes, besides that.
You know, with
that.
A completely new, green, young person sitting here on the sofa.
But, I mean, it does, it creates a statement. It's a good idea to be interested in things and to
I must say that I suppose what occurred to me was, oh gosh, you're supposed to be interested in something.
Yeah. It confirmed your membership in the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, right. So, and there were people in political science. I know Jane Goss was not particularly interested in the League of Women Voters, but she was an artist. She was a very good artist in her own right, and I think a member of the Art Guild. And so she really had an interest to concentrate on that was very important to her. And her work was good. This is the thing that impressed me about the faculty wives that were doing things. They were really doing top-notch work. And, there's still... Mrs. Ted Morgan is still around, and she's always... been an artist and is an artist, exhibits her stuff and is really professional, not just an amateur about it.
And Kay Hawkins.
How's she? I haven't seen her since the
She's
Indonesian
fine.
Project days. Good. Yeah. So, the times do have something to do with people's actions. I know that Marion Kirk seemed to think it was peculiar that I was working. I ran into her on the square one day. I guess that's the period when I was working over in the Senate, stenographic pool there, and she was so interested that I was working. Huh. And she said, "My, it must be nice to be working in a job like that." Made some rather innocuous remark. To me, it sounded sort of innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but when you look,
why does this seem peculiar to her? But I don't think that Marion ever did. And then, of course, her husband became president of Columbia, and she, I think, loved the kind of social life that went with that sort of position. Mm. There again, I think many women now don't love that sort of social life. In fact, I was reading about the wife of president of Yale University, I think it is, who's a career woman, and just they have a rather small official social life, and it's understood that they will, and they just don't regard it in the same way that presidents and university presidents' wives used to. And it was quite a revealing piece that I read about her.
Where'd you read this?
New York Times, I guess.
Hmm.
So, the times have changed.
It's a subject of Karen O'Neill has done a lot of looking into this, the role of the administrator's wife, and
has she?
Yes, she's uh-huh. She's written on it, I think, and has and certainly been doing research on it, serious, because it's a. She herself would be clearly a career woman, I think, if she
would
could.
I don't know her well, so that.
She's a remarkable woman.
I've met her a couple of times there when she's done things for university wives over there, but I haven't gotten to know her, but she's a wonderful-looking person, and wonderful personality, I think. Yeah. What is her forte?
Well,